Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show. We are back. It's been a while. It's probably to the chagrin of some, but once again, 2020, the first edition, the first 2020 version of the most scintillating hour in finance radio, and it still is. But this week, again, to the chagrin of some, this week it's not the best hour in finance radio. It's the best 2 hours. It's a New Year's gift or curse, depending on how you're, you know, which side of the argument you're sitting on, which side of the aisle, which side of the, you know, whether you like it or hate it. But we're here for 2 hours, a little special programming exception this week only. It's a one-time deal. It's a one-time deal. We should have promoted or something, Darren. They probably wouldn't have done that, though, because it would have scared away the audience. They'd have been like, the listenership would have, like, dropped by a half.
There's still time.
Well, you're right. Yeah,
get out your phone and get on Twitter right now.
Well, I know, but I don't want the ratings to tank. I mean, like, they're giving this guy more than an hour? Are these people out of their minds? No, we got a good one. We got a good one today because we're going to do market update, go through our normal stuff, and do a combined deal. We got a radio interview coming up with the professor, the good professor, as I call him. It's been a while since he's been on the show, but Professor David Collum, who's an organic chemistry professor at Cornell. And you might be sitting there going, hey, Zach, why would you have an organic chemistry professor on the show? Well, if you've heard him before, he's a bit of a not a bit. The guy is a Renaissance man. Very accomplished investor in his own right, and I would say a prominent voice in the financial media as well. It's kind of a shared passion of his: finances and investing, economics, and then also organic chemistry. He knows a little something about that. And the other reason why I wanted to have him on, and Darren, I think you'll like this, is he is essentially — I've tried to prod him many times, but he's essentially stayed out of the whole climate change, you know, argument, even though he's an organic chemistry professor. Might know a little something about that. Certainly knows how to read these scientific papers and glean a lot more from them than the average Joe, yours truly included in that. And I've been prodding him a lot just because, you know, on the whole climate change thing, I'm a bit torn because I think the title climate change is a bit of an oxymoron. The climate has been changing since humans have been living on the earth. And so how much do we attribute it to man and, you know, all that other kind of stuff? He finally has decided he was going to dig into it. And so I'm really looking forward to chat with him about that, you know, a little discussion about climate change. And again, one of the other reasons I love talking to the guy is he's got a very libertarian/conservative view of things. Yet he's a professor, a PhD at Cornell University. I keep joking with him and saying, hey, professor, I'm still expecting the people to show up with pitchforks and torches to chase you off the campus. Right? He is not a safe space type guy. He's a dangerous space type guy. So anyway, he's right up our alley. He's going to be joining us today. And, you know, it's invaluable. He's quite the character and very brilliant guy. Had him on the show before and everybody loved it, and we've been meaning to get him back. And so we got him. But anyway, let's get into what a year, first of all. Holy smokes. And I want to put a little context before we get in the market update, a little context, because look, I'm 37, quickly coming up on 38, which now sounds young, but I remember a time not too long ago where I would have thought, man, you're old. But anyway, I think, and it could, again, it could be my limited time frame, but I feel like one of the biggest scourges in the world right now, especially in the world of finance and economics, is context. It's a world devoid of context. People make these outrageous claims and they don't put them into context. And it happens on both sides of the political aisle. It happens especially in the financial world. There's so many issues with context. For instance, let me just throw one out here. One of the arguments you will hear for record high valuations on the market, which we've been talking about for a while, and last year is proof that record high valuations do not mean that more record high valuations aren't coming. And we've said it before, we've said it again, valuations are something we want to pay attention to, but you don't make moves solely based on valuations, right? Because overvalued things can tend to get much more overvalued, and those periods of overvaluation can last much longer than anybody anticipates. So let's provide some context in here. I hear everybody constantly talking about record low interest rates, justifying record high equity prices, record high stock prices, record high real estate prices, record high bond prices, everything, right? Well, because interest rates are low. And the basic logic is this: if I'm making 1.5 or 2% on a U.S. government bond, and historically my average was 5 or 6%, then naturally, because I'm being paid less, I'd be willing to take on more risk in equity markets because my upside is significantly larger than 2%, right? Whereas if a U.S. government bond was paying 7%, I bet everybody listening to this show right now would have less exposure to stocks. So there is some truth to it. But let's run that out completely because it doesn't really wash. If that was the case, if record low interest rates equaled record high stock prices, explain Europe and Japan, right? You got negative rates in Europe and Japan, and yet their markets are, you know, somewhere like half the valuation of ours. And so that alone blows it. Now, there are reasons for that. I'm not saying they're not. But all too often you see people, and I'm going to throw the word charlatan out there, and I don't apply it to everybody saying this, but I think people really mistake circumstance with rules. For instance, we sit back and we look at an environment like today where we've got record low interest rates and record high stock valuations across the board on most metrics. And that hasn't changed since we started talking on the air to you guys 3 years ago. But even more, you know, valuations have obviously after last year gone significantly higher. And guys, I think it's important when we talk about valuations. I always skip past this. And then I talk to clients and I realize that there's a lot of misinterpreting what I mean. When we're talking about valuations, I'm not talking about the price of the stock. I'm talking about the amount of profit produced by that company in relationship to its stock price. And I'll go back to the corner store analogy. If we got a corner store on sale for $1 million and they want to buy, the first question we're going to have as investors in that corner store is, how much profit do you make? And if they look at me and they say, you know, last year we did $150,000 in profit. This year we're looking at $200,000. $1 million for that sounds pretty good. Whereas if they tell you they made a profit of $25,000, now $1 million, you're looking and going, $1 million to make 25. Holy smoke, that's going to take me 40 years to recover my money. Doesn't sound very good, right? So that's what we're talking about when we talk about valuations. And what you'll notice if you pay attention to financial media, CNBC, everybody is always trying to come up with a reason why things are the way they are rather than just coming out and saying, yeah, it's overpriced, right? Oh, it's record low interest rates. Well, again, explain to me Japan and Europe. Doesn't work there. Why does it work here? So one of the things that we talk about, and I put this out recently, was I said, look, don't confuse a rule with an observation, meaning that, yes, you've got record low interest rates and record high stock prices. It does not mean that the two are interlinked. It does not mean that they're inseparable, right? The other thing is this. The relationship between the valuation of stocks and bonds could stay the same place where it is. Maybe that rule is correct. And you could still see stocks drop 40 or 50%. And you could see, you know, treasuries, you know, a corresponding move. Right? So the interrelationship between the value of both asset classes could stay where it is, and yet prices overall could drop through the floor. It's just faulty logic. And I think this happens because nobody wants to get on the air or nobody wants to get on the TV and tell you, yeah, we don't really know. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Right? Because I don't care what the interest rates are. When you show me a company, and there's too many out there to even name, that are trading at 25 times revenue and burning, you know, $500 million a year in cash, meaning that it's not a self-sustainable business. Look, it's a matter of time. And I don't know when, but there is no interest rate that justifies that price. That's lunacy. It's absolute lunacy. The only way anything works like that is if for the next 20 years, the growth trajectory of that company stays completely stable. At some point, they convert to profitability, and the revenue just keeps growing and growing and growing at current paces, and the underlying economy doesn't change, and all of those things stay static and the same for 20 years. When has that ever happened? It hasn't. And that's where the whole marketing side of finance comes in, guys. That's where you've got to understand that you're never going to hear these guys on Wall Street come up there and go, yeah, it's not a good time to invest. Now, am I saying now's not a good time? No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying context. Let's be happy about last year, but put it into context. So now as it gets to last year, was last year a great year? Yes. Was it anywhere as close to as great as everybody says? No. Why not? Let's look at the last 2 years in conjunction. What is the market up over the last 2 years? It's up about 16.5%. 17, somewhere in there. Which is, look, that's slightly below normal. Or slightly below average anyway. Right? It's about a 7.5%, 8% return on an annualized basis. Now, here's the flip side of that coin. The flip side of that coin is all those people out there saying that last year, oh, it's too good. You know, you can't expect that much this year. No, not true. I wouldn't be surprised to see the stock market up another 20% this year. Why? Again, context. Let's go back to it. What has happened over the last 14 months? Have we seen an explosion in economic activity? No. Have we had a trade resolution with China? We had a phase one. Go read the phase one. It means nothing. There's nothing there. It's not a knock on Trump, not a knock on him. There's nothing there. It's basically an agreement to keep talking about it. And I will stick to my guns of what I have said now for months. You're not going to see a comprehensive trade deal before the election, not unless China implodes. Now, things don't look good in China currently. Things are getting worse. It's not, you know, again, it's not blinking red light, get the heck out of the way yet, but it's certainly not trending the right direction. But I don't see that materially, with China. China's a black box. Who knows? And I don't want to make strong statements on either side of it because nobody knows. It's a closed economy. We know as much as they tell us. I mean, that's essentially it. We got guesses. We know that things are really screwed up there. We know that things are askew. We just don't know the actual reality of it. But what has really happened? Not a lot, guys. Economic growth has slowed down. Profits have still increased, but on a very questionable basis. It's certainly slowed down. The rate of growth has slowed down on profits. As a matter of fact, profits came in significantly below expectations last year. And what happened on the market? It soared. Why? Well, for the same reason it's done it over the last 10 years. You had three Fed rate cuts in a single year. First rate cuts since 09 or since 08. So over a decade. And then the Fed initiated their standing repo facility in September, and boom, within 30 days from them starting to pump money back into the market, we made new all-time highs. Okay, context. Let's put it into context. What's going on? Now, that being said, does that mean the bottom's going to fall out tomorrow? No. I've heard guys saying the bottom's going to fall out for the last 10 years. Hasn't. What does it mean? If you listen to the show, you're like, oh, don't say it again. Yeah, it does. Risk management, guys. Don't let what happened last year sway you one way or the other. Stick to the plan. Now, I will say, right now is a phenomenal opportunity. I know there are so many out there because you came to the class that we did in, was that December? Yeah, second week of December, I want to say. First week of December, something like that. There's so many of you out there that listen to the show on a regular basis, and I appreciate all of you for doing it. But now is a really good opportunity, considering what just happened last year, to look at your portfolio and see how you did. If you're 100% stocks, how did your portfolio do? How far away was it from the S&P return, which is right around 30%? Right? Figure out how good the fund, figure out why. Now, if you're 100% stocks, you did 20% last year, that's not too hot. Figure out why. Are your expenses too high? Are the funds you're in bad? Is the guy picking the individual stocks, you know, and again, I hate to cover it all with performance because maybe it's a value, you know, maybe it's a value portfolio, which we run. One of the many portfolio offerings we have. And our value portfolio didn't blow it out of the water, but that's part of our clients' portfolios, right? Now, here's where it gets really interesting. Look at how your portfolio performance was last year if you were 60% stocks, 40% bonds. It's probably really bad in comparison to a 30% gain on the market. And then let me, I'm not trying to put salt in the wound, but let me just tell you, the average 60-40 portfolio with our clients that were 60% stocks, 40% our bond alternative strategy, those portfolios were up, you know, again, I don't want to state specifics because it depends on how it's allocated, but those portfolios were up, you know, 14 to 20%. Right? So this risk management that we're talking about is not costing clients upside. This is what I've been preaching to you guys forever. We can get safer. We can lower fees. We can increase upside. There's a smarter way to do it because here's the other thing, guys. We're 11 years into this thing. And I got no clue when it's going to end. If you told me right now we were going to roll for another 5 to 6 years, I wouldn't be surprised. Why is that? Well, wait a second, Zach. You've been talking about how expensive everything is. Now the economy. Yeah, but again, context. What's driving this market? It's not economic fundamentals. Look at the last year. It's a perfect example. Look at the forecast for this year. You got a massive mismatch in underlying economic performance, corporate profitability, corporate debt levels, and equity prices. It's a mismatch. Could that mismatch last for a lot? Yes. But it's not going to last forever. It's not going to last as long as your retirement. And I think that's the thing that makes me most nervous right now is after last year, we've watched, I've been saying this for year and a half, but we've been watching this appetite for risk climbing as markets go up. And that's just the opposite of the way that we should be thinking. We should be thinking about risk management. We should be thinking and looking at a year like last year and go, man, that was a pretty good year. And there wasn't really a lot of underlying impetus for that. Maybe now is a good time to really pursue a risk management strategy. Maybe now is a good time to make sure that I don't give back everything I've made over the last 7 to 8 years in the next nasty downturn, if that should happen at some point. Well, not if, when, right? And there's so many, the other side of it, guys, there's so many threats out there, but the other side of it is just looking at these portfolios, looking at how exposed these people are to risk, especially in the typical 70-30 stock bond portfolio, 60-40 stock bond portfolio. And then there's some of you out there that I'm talking to who I see a lot more of that. Oh, I don't own any bonds, Zach. I know they're bad. I listen to you. I know they're not bad. What do you got? Stocks. Guys, don't gamble your future on the, be disciplined. Don't be greedy. There's a better way to do it. We can lower your fees, lower your risk, and increase your upside. It's not rocket science. It's just a better way to do it. You know, one of our bond alternatives, and again, I'm not quoting performance, Darren, but even this kind of blew me away. One of our bond alternatives, again, that's insured against loss, indexed to the market, no fees, right? No risk of loss. One of them was up like 18.5% last year. Now, that's not normal. But, you know, if you're one of these guys that's buttoned down because you think the world's coming to an end, which I completely understand. And because of that, you're sitting in, you know, CDs and cash and U.S. Treasuries. You know, you made like 2% last year. You can be just as safe in these alternatives and still participate if the market keeps rocketing higher. I'll say it to the day I die, guys. There's a better way to do it. And if you want to know what that better way is, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. You go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Go to bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. Request a free booklet that talks about our bond alternative. You can schedule a meeting with us. We can bring you the booklet. We can also bring you the other portfolio information, show you the performance, show you the fees. We're wide open, guys. We're an open book. Give us a call. Educate yourselves. Figure out, wait a second, Zach, are you telling me I can take 50% of my risk exposure off the table and not lose upside potential and lower my fees? Yes. That's what I'm telling you. Right? If this was just me blowing smoke, we wouldn't be on the radio still. Dory certainly wouldn't be a client of ours. I'm not trying to demean anybody that hasn't called us or any. And maybe you don't go with us, but just learn about what's out there. I was sitting with a client the other day, a prospective client. He goes, "Man, you're passionate about what you do." And I'm like, yeah, I am. I am, because this is the rest of your life. This is literally what you've worked for. All those 40 years of you getting up early in the morning and staying home late and missing family functions or being late to them and missing moments with the kids and your good parents. You try to make up for it on the weekend, but you're saving to provide. Now's the time. Now's the time. We're not playing craps here, right? This isn't a casino. Don't be gambling the rest of your life that you've literally spent the last 40 years stacking bricks to build something. Right? Now's the time, guys. And maybe meeting with me. And you don't have to meet. You can even email us directly from the website. We can do correspondence over email. But educate yourself and have an open mind. Especially if you're out there sitting in the traditional stock bond portfolio, or if you got $500,000 sitting there in cash or $1 million sitting there in cash. I see it all the time, sitting there in CDs making 2% or 1% in a money market account because you're scared to death. Guys, you've got every right. It's 100% rational to be scared to death, but there's a better way to do it. We can protect you against financial disaster and still have you participating in the upside of this market. And do it all with no fees. That's just the bond alternative side. Now, I don't recommend all of that being in the bond alternative, but I certainly recommend the portion that you've got sitting in cash or CDs or bonds to be in that. Why? Because you can make 13 to 15 to 16% in a single year when the market goes nuts like it did last year. Is that a normal return? No, it's not. We're talking about investments that are going to average 5, 6, 6.5% over the long run. But the point is that when you get these massive moves, you're not sitting on the sidelines. It's just, drives me crazy. Anyway, I go on and on. So you guys, if you want to get the booklet, if you want to know how we do what we do, you can call us again, 866-779-RISK. You can go to the radio show website. You guys know the drill. Just educate yourselves. Know what's going on. So that's about it for the market. This is going to be extended because up next, we're going to be bringing on Dave Collum for the interview, Professor Dave Collum. And we'll do a wrap-up segment. We didn't get into all the market update here because I went on a risk management rant, which has been known to happen, if you've heard the show before. We'll do a closing segment where we cover some of this stuff. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. I wanted to get into what's going on in Apple. I think it's fascinating. I also want to talk about the gold and the dollar, both of them been rallying together, talking about for a long time. Again, if you're just now listening, when we see the gold and the dollar going up at the same time, that is a sign of financial stress. Well, we just came off one of the best years in the last 30. Why would there be signs of financial stress? I don't know, but it's something that we should be paying attention to, right? It's confirmation. When we have a year like we had last year, the dollar should have dropped precipitously. It didn't. Why? Because whatever financial strains caused the Fed to put that standing repo facility in September, they're still there. As a matter of fact, this last week, it was the first oversubscribed period of time since the Fed launched the standing repo facility, where their repo facility, which is an overnight bank lending, is a very crude way to describe it, but it was actually oversubscribed. That shit is going nuts, right? There's still stress in the system. And as always, financial markets are not reflecting that. So anyway, lot to cover, but let's wrap this up. We're going to be right back with Dave Colum. Stick with us. Special two-hour show, to the delight of some, to the chagrin of many. But it is what it is. Anyway, stick with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach discuss key investment strategies across several asset classes, not just stocks and bonds. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. And Zach, 2020 promises to be a crazy election year that will no doubt have an impact on the markets. What's the number one thing investors need to be aware of?
Dory, I'll tell you the same thing I told you when you and Suzanne became clients. Risk management. We're looking at 10 to 15 new prospective client portfolios every week. And I see two things. A, people are being far too cautious. Or B, people aren't being nearly cautious enough. And remember, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We can take less risk, pay far less in fees, and increase our upside potential. And our free booklet, Common Sense Investing, will show you exactly how we do that.
Call Zach right now to get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK or knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement where the firm's licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor. One of the biggest mistakes you can make heading into retirement is not planning for the high costs of an extended healthcare situation. A lot of people think, I got enough money saved, and then they watch everything they've worked hard for get whittled down to nothing from the ongoing costs of a long-term care situation. Do not make that mistake. By putting a long-term care plan in place, you guarantee yourself a source of funds to pay for care when needed, and you also know you won't become a burden on your family. Do what my wife and I did. Go learn about all the new long-term care plans offered by 525 Advisors. These new plans protect your savings, protect your family, and pay your estate back if you never use them. Learn more by attending one of the upcoming classes taught by Brian Ott. He's the host of Long-Term Care Radio right here on Cairo. Brian has a couple long-term care planning classes coming up February 8th and the 21st. Seating will be limited for these, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. The class is free, and you'll get a copy of Brian's great book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And welcome back, and thank you so much for sticking with us. So we want to get right into this next segment. Now, I teased this a little bit in the market update and wanted to talk about some interesting things. We ranted, so we didn't get to all the stuff in the market update, but I wanted to talk about some interesting anomalies that I'm seeing. From all the time that I spend meeting with prospective clients and everybody, great company, Apple, right? To show you the kind of stuff that has me concerned. If you own Apple in your portfolio, you're probably doing backflips. And full disclosure, we did own it. We sold it around $270 a share a few weeks back. Do I wish I'd have held it? Hindsight's 2020, right? Let me explain to you. You know what? Let's attack this from a different angle. Let me explain to you why we sold it. And I'm going to get around to what I'm talking about when I said that there's all these anomalies going on, that last year wasn't as great as everybody thought it was. Now, the rationale behind the move in Apple, because there's always got to be a reason, right? Which I'm going to go off on a diatribe here. I think the thing that is the funniest to me is if you watch CNBC or Bubble Vision, as we like to call it, because they just, you know, it's cheerleading the stock. If you're not participating, you're an idiot. Look at all the money you could have made. And they play all the game. My favorite game, Darren, have you heard this one? My favorite game is, had you invested $10,000 at this moment in time in this particular stock, here's what you would have made, right?
It's a game you can't win.
Oh, it's a game you can't win. And here's the ridiculous part of it. Do you know how many people would have invested in that stock and held it? And then here's the other thing. Had they taken that approach with other stocks of that kind, it's fairly likely that 9 out of 10 of those stocks went to zero, and that one stock made their returns probably pretty close to what they would have made had they been invested in the entire stock market the entire time, right? Now, there are exceptions. There are exceptions. But, you know, how many people rode Amazon up to the top in 99, 2000 and held it all the way until 2000, I think 11 or 12 when it made new highs? You had like a dead decade in there. How many people? And now you're looking to go, oh, you're an idiot if you sold it. Well, yeah, but what did you make during that lost decade? And then maybe you turn around and add it to your portfolio again at some... Anyway, it's just... That's why we call it bubble vision. It's just ridiculous. It's like a stock market. It's like a stock market investing infomercial. If you call now, but wait, there's more, right? We'll give you the Ginsu knife that can chop through 3 pounds of leather sheeting and cut up a penny at the same. You know what I mean? It's just nonsense. And at no point do they talk about risk management or, you know, any of these other things. So just it's bubble vision, but they're always going to ask, okay, this stock's up. Tell me why. No one knows why. It's an exercise in futility. It's up because more money went in than there were. The buyers were more aggressively bidding to buy than the sellers were bidding to sell. That's why the stock went up. Okay, it's the old line in Wolf of Wall Street where he goes, "It's a stock. It's a woozy. It's a wuzzy. It's a it's vapor." Right. And. Look, there's more science to it than that. I mean, they're obviously, but he had a really good point that these interim moves over periods of time, they reflect more emotion than anything else. And so the story behind this parabolic, and it is parabolic, meaning that we have not seen a market cap rant, meaning we have not seen Apple gain this much market cap valuation at any point over the last 20 years in such a short period of time. We haven't seen any kind of ramp like this over such a short period of time. Pull it up on a chart. The thing's just going vertical. Okay. And what's the story behind it? The story behind it is the 5G rollout that's beginning this year. Now, on the face of it, that makes sense. Will they sell more phones than they did last year? Probably. But again, context. Let's put next. The context is this. At no point over the last 15 years has Apple performed worse financially than it has over the last 3 years. Revenues, profits, everything have declined. Okay? Not flatlined. They haven't gone negative, not even close. Apple's still a cash flow and behemoth. I love the company, love the products, nothing against it. But look at the unbelievable revenue growth and profit growth that Apple had over the last 15 years. It's incredible. Right? Now, interestingly enough, the current valuation, Apple's trading right around a 26, 27 price to earnings ratio right now. That is the highest valuation that Apple has had by far at any point over the last 15 years. Yet at the same time, the underlying stock, the company, is performing worse than it has at any time over the last 15 years. And not to mention the fact that you're approaching that $1.5 trillion mark on the total value of Apple shares outstanding. So what that means is that you have to believe that this ramp on 5G phones is not only going to be good, but it's going to be the greatest phone ramp they've ever had, right? Because the valuation has spiked way above at any point in the history. The company's already, and the company is presently at its largest valuation in history. The underlying fundamentals have slowed down. I mean, your expectations for the sale of the Apple 5G phone, they must be sky high. And remember, if you're buying the stock now, it's not just whether you think, you're buying it because you think it's going to go up, right? So we've got such a valuation gap between what is currently going on and the current valuation that it's not just about filling that gap and making today's valuation make sense. We've got we got a Grand Canyon type cavern between us and the current valuation and what's currently going on. You're going to need an incredible rollout on the 5G phones just to justify the prices today. But you're not buying the stock right now because you want to own it at today's prices. You're buying the stock because you think that it's got significant ramp or a significant runway to growth in the future. Now, here's the other thing you got to remember. Let's say it is a stupendous rollout. You got the law of large numbers working against you. Meaning we're talking about a company that's at a $1.5 trillion market cap. Say that out loud a few times. The rollout of this phone better be unbelievable. Because think of the numbers you got to produce to move a needle. Right? Apple's looking at companies that it knows it can buy that could drop $2 to $3 billion to the bottom line. And that's kind of meaningless to them because they're so big. What does an extra $2 to $3 billion in profit a year do to them? Not much. Think about that. So every dime the stock goes up, you're raising the bar for the unbelievable expectations you've got for this stock. Not to mention the fact that I just think it's a perfect hallmark of the current insanity that are these markets. Now, does that mean they're going to go down? No. If you put a gun to my head and put an odds-on favorite of what I think is going to happen, I think this year markets will probably go significantly higher than most are anticipating. Why? Because the Fed is priming the pump. My whole point is, though, is that, guys, I'm speculating. Everybody's speculating. What is the only thing we know for sure? How much risk are we exposed to? What are our financial goals? And do those things match up? That's it. Quit worrying about what Apple does. But I do want you to take a step back and look at the whole picture and go, something's amiss here. Because it is. As a matter of fact, it's never been more amiss. I mean, I love Apple. Just bought my wife the AirPods for her birthday. Those AirPods are actually pretty nice, too. Pretty cool. They link up. The thing I love about Apple stuff is how easily it connects. See, now I'm sitting there talking about why I like Apple. This is not a negativity like, you know, the world is falling apart, the sky's falling. One of my clients emailed me recently. He's like, you know, Zach, your whole sky is falling thing is really coming under pressure. And I said, what are you talking about? Have you seen the performance on your portfolio this year? He goes, well, yeah, but you're negative. And I go, well, yeah, but we're still staying the course here. I, you know, just because we're staying the course and sticking to the way we're doing things doesn't mean that I can't put my head out the window and look around. That's the other miss. Looks at it and goes, well, you know, Zach, you know, you've been issuing these warnings for a long time, but market was up 30% last year. And I go, well, it's up 16% over the last 2 years. It's actually below the long-term average, but yeah, we had a good year. And they go, well, yeah, but you know, you've been saying everything's going to, and I said, no, I haven't. I didn't say everything was going to fall apart. I mean, eventually it will, right? I mean, if you don't think that, then there's no saving it. You know, by all means, go put all your money in Tesla, and Tesla's another one. See, most guys that have so vociferously gone after a company like Tesla wouldn't want to bring it up. Because had you been buying Tesla stock the whole time that I'd been telling you it was going to go to, you know, that it was a joke, hey, you've done really well. I mean, I don't even really know what to say on that one, except I will say this. We never shorted it. We were long Tesla once for like 2 or 3 days on a quick trade, made a quick 6-7% or whatever and got out. But, that's another one. Client asked me, you know, what's going on with Tesla? I don't know, guys. I don't really have an explanation for that. They're pushing $100 billion in market cap now. They're still burning cash like crazy. Everybody's excited about them going into China, but China's electric vehicle sales are falling off the map. It's a cult stock. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, there's no way. Another guy online asked me the other day, he's like, you know, what do you think it's worth? And I said to him, I don't know. I got no clue. How much would you pay for a company that's doing $22, $23 billion in revenue and burning $3 billion a year? $100 billion? $200 billion? I don't know. All right, it's just faith. And I, it's just not my style. I just don't. Faith is for Sundays. And faith is for, you know, my spiritual life. It's not for investing. Yeah, well, they, you know, faith for to guidance and clarity and wisdom and all, you know, all that kind of stuff. But you know what I mean? It's I don't worship at the altar of Elon Musk or any other CEO. Again, I just think it's a hallmark of the times. You know, people are like, well, it's still real money. Yeah, it is. It is. It's just the real kind of money that can evaporate in a very short period of time. And yeah, it's wild. I wish I had more to say about it. I can't make heads or tails of it, guys. I just, you know, maybe you're looking for more insight there, but that Tesla one has just blown my mind. it is currently now, did you know this, Darren, that Tesla is now worth more than Ford and GM combined?
You're kidding.
No, no.
How? There's so many more Fords on the road.
Right. Well,
Ford, and decades of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, Ford and GM have fleas. These are not great companies, right? Not anymore. They got issues. They got balance sheet issues. They got a lot of debt. There's stuff like, but you're talking about companies producing massive amounts of profit. And the one thing I will say to Tesla is the speed and at which they've been able to build things out. I mean, basically, they started building that gigafactory over there in China like 10 months ago, and they're already rolling the first cars out. It's been incredible. But everybody's forgetting that you don't get paid by revenue. You get paid by profit, and there's still not a clear – I mean, the profit story with Tesla is still smoke and mirrors. You know, there's still you have to take it all on faith. The company projected it'd be wildly profitable by this time, and it's not. And everybody's just skipping past that. If you couldn't believe the forecast of profitability 3 years ago, why do you believe them now? But yeah, Ford and GM, it's worth more than Ford and GM combined.
Wow. Are other cities in America experiencing the growth in Teslas on the road that we are in Seattle?
Well, no, you got a concentration up here in Seattle because we're essentially the new Silicon Valley North.
Right.
You know, and tech people.
That's what I've always thought because I'm seeing tons of them, but I figure it's just here.
Well, I mean, there's certainly more Teslas on the road here than like in Waco, Texas, right?
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Or even Spokane, right? And a lot of it's just to do with the culture and, you know, the environment and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, a lot of folks around here worried about the whole green thing.
They sure are beautiful cars.
Well, some of them. I think the Model 3 is an eyesore.
Well, hold on. I have to look up what that is.
The Model 3 to me looks like Volkswagen, like a Volkswagen Bug and a Ford Taurus had a child. That's what it looks like to me.
I can kind of see that.
The Model S to me is gorgeous. It's a heck of a car.
And the X.
The X is a good-looking car, too. That's a heck of a car as well. The problem is they can't make any profit on them, right? And everybody's raging about the technology in Tesla. The Porsche, the new Porsche electronic vehicle, now it's more expensive, but the Porsche blows it away. You know, the car and driver's coming out and say it blows it away. I mean, it's a better car. Now it's more expensive, and I'm not saying that Tesla's going to zero. I'm not one of these guys. I'm just saying, you know, much like Netflix, much like Apple's in a different category. The valuation on Apple is mind-numbing as well. But, you know, Apple's also got a pile of cash. They're the greatest cash generator of all time. But, I mean, the list goes on and on about these companies where the valuation, you look at it and just go, you know, Beyond Meat. Beyond Meat's up 20% now in the last 2 days because they're doing trials with McDonald's. Trials. These are the times we're living in, people. Thank you, Federal Reserve, for the absolute insanity that is currently happening. Anyway, those were some things I wanted to hit on. Like I said, gold and the dollar rallying together, that's a really interesting sign to me because it should not be happening with markets going ballistic like this. When you see the dollar going up in value, where are we at today on the Dixie? We're still at 97. I mean, it's not a breakout one way or the other, but If you told me at the beginning of last year, the S&P is going up 30%, Zach, where do you think the dollar is going to be? And I'd be like, oh, it's going to go down, right? Because, again, the dollar is a reflection of risk. It's much like treasuries. That's the other thing is that treasuries barely moved last year. And I'll say it again. The bond market and the currency markets are telling us something very different than what's happening in the stock market. That being said, I'll say it again. When the Fed is standing there priming the pump like they currently are, It can go up quickly. And this, to me, is the biggest danger that I see. We have been trained over decades to look at the stock market and assess economic health and use the stock market as a way to evaluate the health of the underlying economy. I am still telling you now that that does not work. It's not working. It hasn't worked for quite some time. How do you know that, Zach? Again, and I beat this horse, you know, ridiculous amounts, but I'm going to do it again. This is still the slowest decade of growth we have got on history, period. And yet markets have gone ballistic. We have slower real growth than we did during the Great Depression, and go look at how markets performed during that 10-year stretch. What's the difference? The Fed was not pumping trillions of dollars into the market. That's it. And the problem with this, the real problem with it, to me, the insidious part of all this, the nefarious aspect of what's going on, is that the Fed is blinding people to the real issues out there. Is everything apocalyptic and about ready to blow up? You could make the case. I don't personally see it that way. But is the market and our asset prices telling us the real story of what's going on? Not anywhere close. And that, to me, is the real nefarious part of it, is that they have muted. It's almost like if they could give you a pill that'll cut off all pain. There's some of you out there in chronic pain. You're like, Zach, that sounds incredible. And I'm with you. But what I'm telling you is, what do we know about pain? Pain is a warning sign, right? That our bodies use to put your hand on a stove. It hurts. Why? Because your body doesn't want all the flesh of your hand to be burned off. There's actually a disorder out there where people do not feel pain, and it's very, very dangerous. That's what the Fed has done. They have exponentially anesthetized these markets. So when reality finally does hit, the moves are going to be biblically violent. And this is why we're telling clients, don't wait for the fire to buy insurance. Especially when you can get that insurance and increase your upside and lower your costs and lower your risk. There's a better way to do it. And look, I know that there's a lot of you out there that as long as the markets are going up, you're going to be like, the guy on the radio blowing smoke. That's fine. It's fine. But don't call me or don't call some, I'm already down 30%. You know, just we've seen this movie before. And if you don't want to see it play out in your own portfolio and disrupt your own life, and or maybe you just want to make more money and pay less fees, give us a call. And I get clear. I'm not guaranteeing you if you come with us, you're going to make more money. Okay? I can guarantee you pay less fees. We'll make certain of that. And we'll make certain that we give you more upside potential. And we'll make certain that you're more secure than you were. We can guarantee those things. But don't have a blind eye to it. It's a fool's game. I don't know when it's going to end. And listen, if you want to worship at the church of what's going on now, I can't stop you. You can find somebody out there that'll tell you. I was listening to a guy the other day. Good track record, smart guy, and good guy. Know his background. He's sitting there saying, we're in the early innings. This is going to go for another 7, 8, 9 years. Okay, you know what? Maybe he's right. But even if he's right, our portfolios that we're building for clients are going to work out better than the standard stock and bond mix. And this is the message that we've been trying to pound home. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. It doesn't have to be binary. One of the things that makes me so passionate about what we do is if we're right, and this is all smoke and mirrors, and reality is going to smack us very hard in the face and much faster than most people think, then our clients are going to be fine. If we're wrong, and debt doesn't matter, and the Fed can print us into prosperity. And I've heard people out there saying that maybe recessions are a thing of the past. Maybe big stock market drops are a thing of the past. Maybe it's just to infinity and beyond. I'm going to bet against that. But is it possible? I don't think so, but I'm not willing to sit here and say it's not. I mean, you can be the judge of that. But if that is the case, once again, when you compare our portfolios we're building for clients, they're going to work better than the typical stock bond approach, and they're going to be paying less fees and taking less risk the entire time. There's a better way to do it, folks. If you want to know it, give us a call, 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. And also pay attention, email in if you want to go to the classes. We got the schedule coming out, I believe, this week for the classes we got coming up this year. We're going to do, I think our plan is to do 5 or 6 of them. First one's going to be in February. We're just finalizing the dates now. But anyway, go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. If you don't want to talk on the phone, if that seems like too big of a jump, you can email us. We can do a phone consultation. We can meet in person. We can get you the free booklet. You guys know the deal. Anyway, this is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
This is Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham. Listen to Zach uncover the truth about the financial markets with simple and honest advice to help you plan for retirement. Get your free copy of Zach's new booklet, Common Sense Investing. Go to knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. And Zach, 2020 promises to be a crazy election year that will no doubt have an impact on the markets. What's the number one thing investors need to be aware of?
Dory, I'll tell you the same thing I told you when you and Suzanne became clients. Risk management. We're looking at 10 to 15 new prospective client portfolios every week. And I see two things. A, people are being far too cautious. Or B, people aren't being nearly cautious enough. And remember, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We can take less risk, pay far less in fees, and increase our upside potential. And our free booklet, Common Sense Investing, will show you exactly how we do that.
Call Zach right now to get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK or knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement where the firm's licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor. Hey, it's Story Monson with Brian Ott from 525 Advisors and host of Long Term Care Radio. And Brian, we have another great question from a listener. Do I have to move into a nursing home to use my long-term care insurance?
You know, Dory, actually, most people start their long-term care journey in their home, and today's plans will pay for that care in your home. The idea of having a long-term care insurance plan is to be able to receive the care you need in the location of your choosing. Plans today are comprehensive, which means not only do they pay for care at home, they'll also pay for care in an assisted living facility, an adult daycare, even a nursing home. By having a plan, you decide where you get to receive care. If you have a question for me, send it to me at 525longtermcare.com. You can also learn about new programs that pay you back if you never use your plan, and you can sign up for one of my free upcoming classes.
Dude, my wife and I did. Sign up for one of Brian's upcoming classes. Classes are free, and you'll even get a copy of Brian's book, which has a ton of great info. Seating's limited, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
And we are back. Thank you for sticking with us. Heck of a show. 2 hours. This seems about right. 2 hours. Maybe three. If we did 2 hours for long enough, then I'd start griping about not having three. Anyway, getting back into some of the bullet points here, we got to make this is going to be a quick segment because we got the interview with Professor David Colum, organic chemistry professor at Cornell. Also, a very one of the brightest and most informed minds in the world of finance that I've ever run across that doesn't do it for a living. Now, he's been very successful managing his own private portfolio, but one of the reasons I love talking to him is because he's not in the industry. And like everybody else, you know, or any other level of profession or any other profession, I think that people that are not chained down with performance anxiety, meaning that there's something that we talk about in investing called career risk. Meaning that if you ever want to know why more people didn't see the crash of 08 and 09 coming, it's career risk. You see the risks out here, but some of them don't materialize. And the number one reason why you lose clients in this business is not because you lose massive amounts of money. And I think you all can relate to that. If losing massive amounts of clients' money lost you clients, nobody'd have a client after 08, 09. What loses you clients, and this isn't my opinion, these are studies that have been done. What loses you clients in this business is not making enough money when markets are going up. That's what really ticks people off. And part of it is because the financial industry itself has trained people that when the market goes up, call your advisor, buy him a nice Christmas gift, and tell him he's the smartest guy in the world. And when your account collapses, it's the market, man. That's what happens. It's the price to pay. It's the price to play the game, right? And I love talking to guys like Professor Colum, who are highly astute and informed investors, but are not inside the mechanism, right? Aren't inside the machine because they've got the freedom to say and look at things in a different way. If you just turn on CNBC, just turn it on for a 10, 20 minute period of time. What you will see is that virtually everybody that comes on from Raymond James and AllianceBernstein and fill in the blanks, and I'm not picking on those firms, but just using them as examples, they're going to tell you that it's constructive. Go look at the economic forecasts that were issued in 2007 about what was going to happen in 2008 and 2009. By average, across the board, the average was 10% earnings growth in 2008. That was the Wall Street consensus. How did they come to that consensus? By literally talking to the companies and asking them how much profit you make next year, adding it all up, and boom, that's what we think is going to happen. Well, I'll just point to Boeing again, right? Did Dennis Muilenburg, the CEO of Boeing, was he feeding you accurate information about what was going to happen when he was talking to Jim Cramer on Real Money or whatever Cramer's show is called? I haven't watched it in so long. But were they telling you that, hey, we got some design flaws, people could die? No, of course not. And I think that's why it's important to talk to people that do this job for a living. And you know, that study it. And one of the reasons that we talk on this radio show to people that have differing views, what we refer to in the industry as variant perceptions outside of the mainstream, is because the mainstream's everywhere. And you'll hear this in the podcast. More him than me, but we get off on a quote-unquote conspiratorial rant as it relates to Epstein and a few other issues. But he makes a really good point. He said, you know, I'm tired of listening to people talk about conspiracies in the pejorative sense, that conspiracies occur. These things happen. So anyway, that's why we're having him on. And that's why I think it's an important interview for you guys to listen to, because it's an incredibly educated man who's been published a million times over. He's a heavyweight in the chemistry world and also a very astute investor. And we cover a lot of things. We go from climate change to finance to politics to Fed to Jeffrey Epstein. I think it's a fascinating interview, and I think it's one that you guys will enjoy. And as always, let's get back to the purpose of the show, risk management. If these things concern you, if you don't think these things are being addressed in your portfolio, if you agree with Professor Colum and I that things are amiss, you need a risk management strategy. You need to know that you can win regardless of what happens out there in the world, and all the while doing it with less risk and less expense. If that interests you, which it probably should, give us a call at 866-779-RISK. Again, 866-779-RISK. Go to the radio show website, knowyourriskradio.com. Go to bulwarkcapitalmanagement.com. And get our free booklet. You can request a meeting with me. We can do it over the phone. You can email us. You guys know the drill. Have a wonderful weekend. We got to run. Stay tuned for the interview because it's a two-hour special show, and the interview is coming up right now. So do not go anywhere. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
Hey, it's Story Monson with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. And Zach, 2020 promises to be a crazy election year that will no doubt have an impact on the markets. What's the number one thing investors need to be aware of?
Dory, I'll tell you the same thing I told you when you and Suzanne became clients. Risk management. We're looking at 10 to 15 new prospective client portfolios every week. And I see two things. A, people are being far too cautious, or B, people aren't being nearly cautious enough. And remember, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We can take less risk, pay far less in fees, and increase our upside potential. And our free booklet, Common Sense Investing, will show you exactly how we do that.
Call Zach right now to get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK or knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement where the firm's licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Seattle's right choice for conservative talk radio. AM 770 KTTH Seattle.
The following is a paid program on this station.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
Welcome to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham on AM 770 KTTH. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Know Your Risk Radio is brought to you by Bulwark Capital Management, helping families navigate the ever-changing and often treacherous financial markets. Know Your Risk Radio starts now. Here's your host, Zach Abraham.
All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. And it is, without further ado, we got to introduce the professor that I refer to him as the professor, the resident doctor of FinTwit, Financial Twitter, Professor David Collum, organic chemistry professor at Cornell University. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, it's good. Look forward to these. The last one we did was a pisser.
Yeah, it was. And we had, you know, you and I were lamenting over this. We had a preliminary interview agreed to by the, was it the head of, or the vice president of the, was the St. Louis Fed? Was that who we were going to have on?
Yeah.
And he,
would have been fun.
He asked you. He was the one that brought it up, and he said he wanted to come on the show and do it. And then he ghosted us.
Yeah, at the last minute, I must have posted a tweet that pissed him off. That's my suspicion.
Well, but you don't do that. You don't ever put anything out there that would draw the ire of central banks, would you?
No, never.
Yeah, that's not your way of things. Well, hey, let's start off with, because I love reading your year in review. Obviously, we can't go through the whole thing. I'm actually going to be sending that out. I probably should ask your permission, but I was actually going to send it out as one of my pieces to my clients.
It's the internet.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Well, that's true. Yeah. It's disseminated wide and large. But kind of give us.
Yeah.
Give us...
I'm going to hide my writings on the internet. Hope no one finds them, right?
Well, so give us an overview, really, of kind of what you saw in 2019. If you can, kind of a summation of your year in review and what you thought was interesting from your perspective.
Well, what I saw and what I wrote about were at some level two different things. So normally what I try to do is pull together everything that I find interesting. And it's just gotten so big and it's gotten so voluminous that I've left a lot on the cutting room floor. So I watch pretty much everything until something catches my eye. I think I might even have a section on the Australian fires already, because I think there's a lot of subplots, you know, going there next year.
Yeah.
We'll see. This time next year, I might have forgotten them. What I did this year, and I've written less about the national politics because it's such a terrible mess, and I don't think I can make any more sense of it because there's so much lying going on. Who knows who should be hung from the neck until dead, and who's the good guy.
Right.
And then what I did this year was I wrote in order of sort of decreasing interest. I started with what was, you know, what I thought was the most important section, and then I just worked down from there. And when I got to the end, and I kind of ran out of gas, but I also ran out of interest, I realized that I had not written much finance, which I usually do, and I had written much more about social issues. And I realized that the financial sector, which I can drone on for pages about, you know, stupid, you know, bond markets and stupid IPOs and stuff like that. But it feels like a sort of a pregame show to me right now. It feels like there's excitement in the air, but there's nothing to talk about yet, right? No one has kicked off the ball. So hopefully we'll end up with some carnage soon and I get to write about fun stuff again. But But the social stuff felt like it was more sort of global and worldly and potentially consequential. So that's how I picked the topics this year. And I realized every single one was a social issue, even though I talk about gold, but that's still a social issue in some sense, right?
Yeah, it is. Now, and we're on a political talk radio show here, so I think it's more than applicable. Give us, from your perspective, and one of the reasons I love talking to you is you've got a very unique perspective as somebody that is intricately watching financial markets and then is also a PhD in organic chemistry at one of the leading universities in the country. So, I mean, you're really seeing this truly. You're entrenched in all sides of this. What were the social issues that you found most confounding or most perplexing or most telling? What give the listeners kind of, a quick bullet point list of the things that really caught your eye the most?
Well, the centerpiece of this year was literally 32 pages written on climate change. And that started out, the whole thing started about 2 years ago when I did what everyone else in my world seems to do, and that is they just listen to everyone say it's a big problem and just accept it. And I actually started the section with a couple of emails that I dug out of my email box, which I said to friends. One of them says, look, I had dinner with the Secretary of Energy, and he says there's not a credible scientist in the world who doesn't believe in climate change. And I said that to, I think, my brother in an email when he was questioning climate change, right? And then someone else, some other doctor, sends me stuff, and I say, look, I don't know any scientists who don't buy this model. So maybe it's not real, but, right? And so, but I'd always pled the fifth on the debate, including to the Secretary of Energy, where I said, look, I'm agnostic. And he was shocked. And I said, well, and I know it takes thousands of hours to make sense.
That's what you said to me.
That's where I came into it. And then what happened was, is about a year ago, it sort of clicked that many, many more people should be agnostic. And so last year I wrote about it from the perspective of a scientist who says my brethren who are signing off on this are not showing very good judgment, and that there's potential problems here, and they're as ignorant as I am, yet they seem to not realize it. And so that was kind of the angle I took about a year ago. And then I got baited into digging in by my brother, by that doctor, and by friends who said, Dave, you've got a big soapbox you get to stand on. It's your responsibility. You should dig into this. And these were climate change believers. Right. These were guys saying, dig into this. And so what I did is I did dig into it. And I didn't get to the level of the primary literature, which is always the refuge of the climate change crowd. Whenever they don't like what you say, they say, well, you got to read the primary literature. I did get to some of it, but there's thousands of papers.
Right.
But I act like a judge and I adjudicate the case where, one lawyer says this, another says this, and there's witnesses, and I go, okay, here's the deal. Boom. I'm not an expert, but I have to pass judgment. Here's the deal. And what I concluded was, after hundreds of hours, maybe, it's hard to count, that the climate change story is really a pile of garbage. And it's not to say that there isn't climate change, there always is, and it's not to say there isn't man-made climate change, but it's so political and it's so scientifically shabby. And it's so politicized that there's huge conflicts of interest. But contrary to what you get told, where you say all the deniers are on the payroll of big oil, I can't find a shred of evidence of that. What I find is what turns out to be an estimated $600 billion climate industry, right? Wow. If you add it all up and all the organizations and departments and grants and solar companies and you name it, something like $600 billion a year is spent on climate change-related stuff. And I realize that if climate change turned out to be a dud, that would all go poof, right?
Yeah.
And so and everyone's attaching.
I mean, Dave.
I mean, I read a story where a guy at Harvard Med School said we're going to all get more kidney stones because you go why? And they go dehydration. I go, well, so as the weather gets warmer, we're going to be too stupid to drink water. What are you talking about, right? So you run into real dumb stuff like that, but I kind of went through all the favorite topics. I had 26 maxims, and every one of them I sort of turned over a stone and said, look at what crawled out from underneath that rock. And I got to the end, And I don't know what's true, but what I can tell you is this, your listeners, here's what I can tell you with great confidence. There's no one in the world who knows what's going to happen 100 years from now. Nobody. Nobody. Zero. Not a chance is there a person in the world. I know what it takes to understand something. I do it for a living. No one knows what's going to happen.
Right.
Number two, there are profoundly prominent scientists who think the climate change story is a hoax. Profoundly prominent. And so that the first big lie is that if you don't believe us, you're just a nitwit. I can give you Nobel Prize winner after Nobel Prize winner who's dug into it, physicists from Princeton, from Stanford, from MIT, and say, this is a load of crap.
Well, Dave, why aren't they giving them – I don't understand why they're so silent. Are they silent, or are they just not given a microphone?
There's a demographic to the deniers, and I'm in it. The deniers are all old white men.
Oh, the scourge.
Now, why? Well, because first of all, it's only at the end of your career that you say, screw it, I don't care. You can accuse me anything you want. I'm 64 years old. I got 5 years of research support in front of me. If somehow I crash and burn because they dub me a loon, that I don't care. I'll be 69, 70 years old. I go, yeah, I'll retire. And then, of course, they're all old white men because, you know, who is in that age bracket who's a scientist? Well, old white men, right? That's it. And so, but, you know, famous physicists like Freeman Dyson from Princeton, but they're all old white men. You look at panel discussions, all old white men. And so, and they're the ones, and they're saying, look, I didn't accept a penny. They keep saying I did. You know, the former founder of Greenpeace, Patrick Moore, the chairman of Hebrew University's physics department. Now, if you think Ashkenazi Jews are smart, then you got to figure the chairman of Hebrew University's physics department is a damn genius.
Yeah.
And he's a solar physicist. He graduated from college at 18. And he says there's not one shred of data that says that CO2 causes warming. Not one shred of hard data. He says it's all the sun. The whole thing is the sun.
Wow.
Now, I don't know if it's that extreme, but then what happened is he published an article in Forbes, and 3 hours later it got pulled. Right? That's kind of garbage. So here's what I found. I found a lot of lying, and it wasn't on the denier side. The changers were I give them names because I got to do it to be a shorthand. So you got the deniers and the changers. Deniers are anyone who questions any aspect of it because they immediately get thrown into that category. But and some of them say, look, I believe there's climate change. I believe it could even be a problem, but I don't believe this part. Boom, they're in trouble.
Right.
They lose their grants. They lose their livelihood. It's that bad.
And where, Dave, where else? I mean, your understanding, I mean, again, we're talking to Dave Collum, professor of organic chemistry at Cornell University, and we're on the subject of climate change. And this was one of the things that I was dying to talk to you about because I was one of the people asking you, I think you and I shared a DM over Twitter about a year and a half ago where I was asking you directly about it. And the answer you gave to me was inconclusive. I haven't done the research. And, you approached it like an academic, and that's why I was so interested in you starting to dig into this. But when you look at the whole complex and you look at all these, you know, the deniers and the changers, I like the shorthand there. What is outside of the money, which the $600 billion blows my mind? You're talking about 3% of GDP is being directed at this, which is just mind-blowing. But
that's not global GDP, though.
Oh, okay, so globally. Okay, gotcha. So I was thinking of here in the United States. Right, okay, that's a good point.
But it's a lot of money.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, 600. I mean, it used to be, right? I mean, I mean, Dave, it's only one-third or almost one-third of Apple's market cap now. So
the base now, right?
Yeah, right. What were I know that you've got some hit points, some very well known, very well propagated nurtured narratives that you found where this is either absolutely false, this piece that everybody's parroting or, you know, trumping around, or where it was completely unfounded. What were some of the hit points, some highlights in there where maybe for you it was even eye-opening where you went, boy, that's just completely wrong?
Well, one of the things is you got to watch out for the start points. And so so if someone shows you temperature rising over the 20th century, no one actually denies that. It turns out that everyone knows it rose over the 20th century. It turns out it's been rising since the middle of the 18th century. And then people say it's the hottest it's ever been. That turns out to be a lie. So previous warm periods that exceeded the current one include going backwards in time, what's called the medieval warming period. And that's when that's actually when the population grew enormously, which ironically led to the densities that allowed the Black Death to go crazy.
Right.
So in some sense, it was the rapid population growth that allowed the plague to really do its thing. But that it sort of set up the Renaissance, and then you got the Roman warming period, which was also hot, and that set up, that's when Rome flourished, right? And again, crops were productive and things like that. And then you go back behind that, it turns out there's one about 2500 BC zone, that area, 5 to 7,000 years ago, and that set up the Egyptian Empire, right? Now, do they correlate? I don't know, but it appears as though humans do well when the weather's warm. And you go, well, I think that makes some sense.
Yeah.
And then you see stupid stuff like someone will say, well, you know, the sea level is rising. And, you know, the thing that drives me crazy is the anecdotal data. So you go around, you talk to anyone about climate change, they'll say, oh, I can see evidence of climate change. And you go, what do you see? And what they cite is just complete and utter nonsense. Let me put it this way. If the climate is changing as fast as they say, the naked eye can't see it.
Right.
The sea level is rising the thickness of a penny per year.
Jeez.
Right? So if you say, oh, yeah, we're having more floods, it's like, you're an idiot. It's been rising the thickness of a penny. You know what it rose in the 20th century? The thickness of a penny.
Wow.
And you know, what happened in the 20th century? I don't remember anything that stood out as unusual. The claims that we're having much worse hurricanes, turns out, you know, people have done deep dives on that. And it turns out that the going back to 1900, in which you can use news reports of hurricanes making land, and you can ask, you know, are there greater serious climate events that have occurred since, say, 1900? And the answer is no. It's statistically undetectable rise in hurricane activity. You look at droughts, it turns out the worst decade of the 20th century was the 30s. You also get into some nuanced stuff, like when they talk about the temperature going backwards, you go, how do you measure it? Does and, you know, I asked my grad students this, do you really think that the guys who are measuring the temperature in 1900 and the guys who are measuring the temperature in 2019 were using the same methods? And the answer is no, but then they correct for it, and I go, oh, and that's where it gets so strange. Because what you find is there's some great, great presentations out there where you can see papers chronologically changing the slope of the temperature over the decades. And here's the irony is they keep dropping the temperature going into the past. So the corrections are saying actually it was cooler and cooler and cooler in the past. And so if you do that, then you get a slope. And so there's some stuff that I consider to be totally scientific fraud. Just complete fraud. And there's this famous thing called Climate Gate where they covered up the fact. The famous hockey stick where the temperature spiked up, that was complete scientific fraud. The course just ruled on it this year that it was scientific fraud. And then there's things like, you know, people show dying polar bears, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
You see this emaciated polar bear, and you go, well, and one day I was in the middle of a podcast with Chris Irons, and it just clicked. I go, okay. Show me a polar bear who's, say, 3 months from death, right? Just pick one arbitrarily. 3 months from dying, an old guy, a real grizzled old bear. What's that bear going to look like? Probably kind of emaciated. Now, the picture of the polar bear they like is this emaciated thing standing on the ice. Well, polar bears can eat a lot of different stuff. And he's standing there right next to the ocean. He can eat the stuff in the ocean, but he's dying. And the question is, why is he dying? Well, that's climate change.
Of course.
It's like, how do you know? How do you know? And here's the funny part. The polar bear population, and they talk about polar bears coming into towns because they're starving. It's like, first of all, I don't know how climate change influences their feeding properties. But second of all, people who monitor polar bear populations say that the polar bear population has tripled since the 70s.
No kidding.
And so all of a sudden you go, oops. Right. So you start finding these stories or not. I saw this great one where this showed burn rates, burn acreage in the southwestern United States. And here's the first hint that there's a problem. They plotted the accumulated burn acreage over time. Now, they didn't plot per year. They plotted accumulated. Now, if I showed you a plot of the accumulated deaths by cancer over the 20th century, it would start in the lower left and go to the upper right. And it would never drop because when someone's died, it just accumulates onto that plot. So go from lower left, upper right. It would look bleak.
Yeah.
And you would not be able to easily see that we've really made huge progress on cancer.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that plot alone. But then I noticed as they divided the burns and the acreage, due to acreage that was burned due to natural causes. And I was prompted to read this paper by an activist, by a scientist activist. I don't believe you can be both, but she thinks she is, to go read this paper. And I read it, and I said, figure such and such looks like a fraud to me. And she was appalled that I would accuse it of being a fraud. And I said, they separated the burn from natural versus human causes. And I go, who thinks they're so smart they can make that distinction?
Right.
Right? If we get a big snowfall this winter, who would be able to divide that into climate change-based snow versus natural-based snow, right? This is stupider than stupid. But then she says, go to the primary literature. So I go to the primary literature, and I see the plot. Now, it's much less visually retrievable. So the report she had sent me to made it, cleaned it up so that you could see it easily. And I compared the original plot and said, yeah, you know, it's still the same plot. It just has a much more sciencey look to it because it has a lot of data built into it. But then I noticed one thing. In the original paper, the y-axis was labeled with the word modeled. Right away you go, oh, red flag. Modeled means they're just trying, they've got some computer, they're chucking at it. This is not raw data.
It's like a back test in the world of investing.
Right. And then what you go to the report and you find they took out the word modeled. It is verbatim the same y-axis, but they took out the word modeled. So there's another fraud. And they do this all the time. And I've got quotes in this write-up from people who say, look, we've got to make up ugly stories. We can't deviate from the narrative. We got to keep it simple. Right. So they're the people who think there's a problem. Think that it's now justifiable to lie. And I think this field is filled with pathetically bad scientists. Now, I'm sure there's some good scientists in there, but they're not speaking up. You know why? Because they're cowards. They're cowards because their careers will be destroyed if they speak up. Thus, you get the old white men again.
Those darned old white men. Oh, we got to take.
Yeah, and they're the only ones who can speak up without fear.
Okay, we got to take a quick break. You got to stick with us through the break here because this is just getting into the heart of the matter here. So, everybody, we are with Professor Dave Colum, organic chemistry professor at Cornell University and a financial expert as well. Stick with us through the break. We'll be right back. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Do better in bull markets. Do better in bear markets. Pay less fees in all markets. You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management. You can subscribe to Zach's free newsletter, The Bulwark Insider Report, at knowyourriskradio.com.
Hey, it's Story Monson with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital. And Zach, 2020 promises to be a crazy election year that will no doubt have an impact on the markets. What's the number one thing investors need to be aware of?
Dory, I'll tell you the same thing I told you when you and Suzanne became clients. Risk management. We're looking at 10 to 15 new prospective client portfolios every week. And I see two things. A, people are being far too cautious. Or B, people aren't being nearly cautious enough. And remember, it doesn't have to be all or nothing. We can take less risk, pay far less in fees, and increase our upside potential. And our free booklet, Common Sense Investing, will show you exactly how we do that.
Call Zach right now to get your free copy of Common Sense Investing, 866-779-RISK. That's 866-779-RISK or knowyourriskradio.com. Investment advice cannot be given without a client service agreement where the firm's licensed to conduct business. Bulwark Capital is a DBA of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.
One of the biggest mistakes you can make heading into retirement is not planning for the high costs of an extended healthcare situation. A lot of people think, I got enough money saved, and then they watch everything they've worked hard for get whittled down to nothing from the ongoing costs of a long-term care situation. Do not make that mistake. By putting a long-term care plan in place, you guarantee yourself a source of funds to pay for care when needed, and you also know you won't become a burden on your family. Do what my wife and I did. Go learn about all the new long-term care plans offered by 525 Advisors. These new plans protect your savings, protect your family, and pay your estate back if you never use them. Learn more by attending one of the upcoming classes taught by Brian Ott. He's the host of Long-Term Care Radio right here on Cairo. Brian has a couple long-term care planning classes coming up February 8th and the 21st. Seating will be limited for these, so sign up today at 525longtermcare.com. The class is free, and you'll get a copy of Brian's great book, too. Go to 525longtermcare.com.
You're listening to Know Your Risk Radio with Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
All right, welcome back. And I'm not even going to waste time. We're going to jump right back into our interview with Professor Dave Colum. And we are in the middle. Now, I know that you guys are used to us talking finance and investing, but we've got a unique opportunity to talk to Professor Colum, who's an organic chemistry professor at Cornell. And we are discussing climate change. And he's done a deep dive into this. And I just want to set the stage again, Dave, for those people that are just joining us. It was about a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, where we first started corresponding. And I remember in one of our first back and forths, I wanted to ask you about climate change because I'm one of those guys who's naturally a skeptic. And some of it came by it naturally. My grandfather, Larry Abraham, wrote a book in 1993 entitled The Greening, where he made the argument, he was making a lot of the arguments that you and I were discussing in the last segment, clear back in 1993, and he was discussing how he believed the motive for this was economic control, another lever of economic control, and that this was all bluster. He cited a lot of the charts and fascinating book, and I'm biased, obviously, as my grandfather, but getting into, you know, I love hearing it from you because the way you approach it is not like a guy like me sitting behind a microphone going, I see some holes in it. You're approaching it as a scientist. You've got every reason to go along with the narrative, and yet you're seeing massive holes. You're seeing stuff in the argument that wouldn't even come close to passing as science the way that you've been trained to do it and the way, you know, the barrier, the standard that you're held to. Dave, have you gotten to the motive outside of people not wanting to lose their jobs? Do you think there's another? Where did this originate from? I mean, I know when I was a kid, it was holes in the ozone. It was this and that. It's been going on for a long time. But do you think my grandfather had a point about it being a lever of economic control or a push toward a one world government? What do you think the genesis of this whole thing is?
Well, it has become about control, no question. And so everyone is attaching their cause to the climate change wagon, and when you see major organizations signing up, part of it's because they know that if they don't, all hell's going to break loose.
Right.
And so you can look and see the National Academy of Sciences has a statement about climate change. Now, here's what I can tell you. There's a lot of people in the National Academy who have no idea that there's even a statement about climate change. What there are is people in the National Academy who sort of grabbed control and created the statement. And so it's not a consensus statement. It's just a statement. And it's, you know, people, serious scientists are going, yeah, do whatever you want. I'm busy, right? And so see, the people who care enough to make statements are the ones who tend to be the climate change guys. There's all sorts of opposition, but you're told there isn't. And so what's the origin of it? Well, first and foremost, you can get deeply into psychoanalytical stuff and say that people are herd animals and they group together. And last year I wrote about the about the dangers of trying to suppress religion. Now, I'm an atheist, so this was an odd thing to write, but I basically said that, look, religion kind of glues society together, and even though I'm an atheist, don't be careful about throwing that out because our whole society is based on sort of following moral values, and, you know, religion helps that as long as it's not too loony, right? And, yeah. And I think if you push religion away, then what you do is people start forming groups by other associating means. And so I think, for example, if you want to understand that, just say, we'll just look at the anti-Trump or pro-Trump crowd, anti-Hillary, pro-Hillary, you name it. Everyone is now forming these groups, and they all agree that they're part of the group. And this is really social structure that we're seeing. So now we seem to have almost replaced religion, which everyone had in the old days, and they all got together and agreed that there was some deity or some number of deities, whatever. We replace it with causes, and I think that's true in so many ways. That's why politics is so. That's why the religious metaphor of people's behaviors, because I think it really has replaced religion. And so now climate change is serving that function. It's an organizing a mechanism for society. Now, once you formulate an opinion on something like this, it's very hard to undo. So it would be very hard for me to undo my skepticism.
Right.
You become a perma something, right? And we know perma bear. And once you're a perma bear in investing, it's very hard to become a bull. That takes tremendous willpower. And so I keep trying to figure out what would change my attitude about the climate community. But I think it's just going to get so wretched and so pathetic that there's no chance. Even if climate change is real, you know, anyone who thinks that being told about climate change by a 16-year-old kid is an idiot, right? You're a complete idiot if Greta Thunberg warms your heart. You're just an idiot. And you say, well, yeah, but the Earth, we're going to destroy our Earth. I go, I don't care what a 16-year-old has to say. She couldn't hold up against me in a debate.
No.
I'm convinced of that.
Not just convinced of it.
They're euthanizable. They're so primal.
And you're not just convinced of it. I mean, she doesn't even know. I mean, to say she wouldn't hold up in a debate, I mean, the thing would be over before it started. I mean, she's just parroting the nonsense that's been fed to her. I mean, I feel bad for her.
This is the lever. This is the control. So your grandfather was right. And so this is about control. This is what the whole social justice movements are. They're about control. They want victories. They want, you know, as the abortion debate kicks in, you got people who want to win by shutting down all abortion. You get people who want to win by having, you know, abortion at birth. Right? Everything's about winning now. And there's just no middle ground. And so now for these tricky topics that require careful analysis, it's hopeless.
It's completely hopeless. It's also the death of logic. Like you were saying, it is hard because I went through a period of perma bear myself, probably up until about 2013. And I made this shift because I had to. I'm running a business and I had to,
right.
I got to make clients money. But you start looking, what I kept telling myself is, look, you got to look at the facts, be agnostic, understand the underlying structural issues, but your job is to make money for your clients and you've got to get past it. The thing that I find fascinating is that there is so little of that anymore. Nobody wants to be objective. Before you're talking about context and how context has disappeared from the debate and on all sides, and it's just who can yell louder and shut down the opposition. And as a man of science, I don't really think, I mean, from what I know of you, if you see the evidence or if you see it pointing in a direction, you're going to follow it. Yet that's the confounding part about the whole climate science or the whole climate change issue that you're shining a light on, is that there's just no there, and you really didn't have a dog in the fight. I mean, I personally heard you say, no comment, pass, I haven't done the work. Then you dig in and do the work, and you go, there's no there. It must be the religious fervor. It's the only thing that really makes any sense of it, because you're right, it's really interesting that correlation that you tied to from religion falling off, and you can see it in all the metrics in the United States. We're much less of a religiously or quote-unquote God-based society than we were, let's say, 40 or 50 years ago. But something, as we've learned in Middle East political issues, a power vacuum must get filled. And that was a really interesting correlation there. Where do we go from here? What is the next push? These people, like you said, they're not going to give it up and admit that there is no God. right? They're not going to turn. Where do we go from here?
You know, I don't actually know. And the the problem is we've never had a world where everyone was so connected digitally.
Right.
And so we've never had a world where you could form such gigantic packs of thinking. And you know, we've never had to deal with, you know, split second associations like this. And, you know, there's no, in the past, you and I never would have been chatting, right? There would have been no mechanism to
right.
chat.
Right.
I talked last week for 2 hours with a guy who runs a nuclear plant. And the question is, how is that possible, right? And the answer is because we cross paths digitally, and the guy wanted to chat. We'd exchange numbers, and we spent 2 hours talking about nuclear energy. That was not possible, right? I occasionally chat with guys like Kyle Bass and Grant Williams and guys like that. And you know, when the repo fiasco occurred, Grant, I spent two and a half hours on the phone on one Saturday night just talking about the repo problems and trying to figure out what they meant. And we both got to the end of the conversation, and we already were there, but we were convinced that no one understands them.
Yeah,
I actually think no one understands them. Actually, I think it's an emergent system. I think it's the banks having a sort of a cardiac arrest, and we're looking for sort of a one-dimensional explanation for why the repo market is spasming, when in fact it's a systems finance problem.
Yeah, no, I came to the same in a much less scientific way. Came to the same conclusion myself, is that we're not going to know the end of the story until we get to the end of the book, just because it's so complex. I mean, you could see repo issues here in the, you know, in U.S. banks that originated in Thailand. I mean, you know what I mean? The way it washes around.
Right.
I mean, these people, that's why I laugh every time somebody comes out with a level of certainty. Now, one other thing I want to jump to, and this may seem like a violent thing, but or a violent transition, but to me it's not. How much of this do you think reflects a little theory I've been working on? Is that, and I'm not saying it's the cause. It's certainly the overactive or over-involved central banker was, you know, around far before, or excuse me, you know, the climate change insanity was long before the hyperactive central banker. But it seems to me that we're living in an area of suspended reality where, and I'm wondering how actions of central banks tie into that, because this whole we can create money out of thin air, we can paper over problems, it seems to me that has provided the economic fuel, if you will, to kind of support this zero gravity environment we're in, where climate change can become this binary discussion where you either believe it or you're a moron, you either believe it or you're castigated from society. It looks like these things have gotten more life and more breath during this era of central banker. Do you see any connection there, or do you think that's me reaching a little too far?
Well, I think the connection could be that I think the average person knows something's out of whack.
Right.
And so even though the stats show, you know, there's 3.7% people who are unemployed, the stats also show there's a 100 million people who don't have a job. And you say, how do you have both of those in the same head? You can't. Right? There's a real problem. They're feeding one of those two data sets is dead wrong. And I think the unemployment numbers are so fabricated. My attention was drawn to some industrial output plot that came out of the St. Louis Fed, and a related one, which I can't remember what it was, but it was something quite related. It was drawn to me on Twitter by someone. And in 2000, I think it was 15, I said, look, I think we're on the cusp of a recession or in one. And if you look at this industrial output plot, every time we have a recession, this thing's dropping. And in 15 and 16, for about a year, a little over a year, it dropped. I'm thinking, did they just lie us through a recession somehow? Right? And during the Weimar, you know, disaster in Germany, people had jobs. Meanwhile, society completely collapsed.
Yeah.
And so the question is, was the economy doing okay because people had jobs, or was it a disaster because the currency got destroyed, right?
Yeah.
You know what I think. And so I think the Fed money pumping introduces an instability, much the way, you know, if you fill up a water balloon with too much water, don't be shocked when something causes it to break.
Right.
And the more unstable it is, the more fuel in the system, right? Look at Australian fires. There's a good analogy. The more fuel in the system, the less it takes to set off a raging inferno.
Yeah.
Even the Australian fires, what a great metaphor. The stories we're told about that being climate change, it could be part of the story, but there's bad land management and all sorts of fiascos are behind the Australian fires.
Well, and I'm hardly the first one to bring this analogy up, but I mean, it goes back to the old, when was, you probably remember it better than I do, well, I guarantee you do, when the whole land management practice here in the U.S. Forestry Service started saying, no, don't remove the underbrush, you're disturbing the native, you know, and then we saw that the incredible pickup in intensity of forest fires. When was that?
You know, it's been a steady drumbeat, right? So
yeah.
Here's the irony. If you had, so what they did in Australia, we're jumping around like we're in the ADHD meds or something. But in Australia, they, some number of years ago, started passing draconian legislation about what fire breaks you could put in and not put in and things like that, which made, therefore, land management inferior. And they said they stopped the burn. So they used to do controlled burns during the wet winter months when the brush was fairly damp, and so it was not hard to control. Now, when you do a controlled burn and Bambi or some koala bear is in the way, they scamper out of the way. But when you have a raging inferno that mows across the continent at breathtaking speeds, they get fried.
Yeah.
And so they're killing more koalas now by not having the control burn than by having it. And it turns out that the idiots, think that they stopped the control burns because they didn't want to put CO2 into the atmosphere because of some Kyoto Accord, right? Well, what I can tell you is that When brush dies, the microbes get to it and it kicks out CO2. There is no difference in whether the CO2 comes off from burning or whether the CO2 comes off from rotting. There's just no difference.
Really?
Yes, none.
I didn't know that.
Right? Where the extra CO2 comes from in the climate story is when you pull it out of an occluded location like fossil fuels. And it comes out of the ground. You say, oh, that was sitting there for many, many, many millennia. Now it's in the air that wasn't in the air. The green stuff, the biosphere produces you know, green shrubbery, and then it falls and rots and produces CO2 in the existing biota, consumes the CO2 as plant food, and it just keeps cycling. And if instead of having a fire, you left that tree and it fell over in the woods, it would put out the same amount of CO2 to the molecule.
Huh. No, I...
And so burning wood doesn't generate CO2 in the atmosphere net. There's no net gain in CO2.
It's going to release it anyway.
It's going to release it anyway. I had to check my wife on that. She didn't want to have a fire one night in the winter. And I said, Candace, this wood's going to give off CO2 one way or the other. She goes, oh, right. And so there, but there, those fires were, the controlled burns were stopped to stop putting out CO2 because of some Kyoto Accord. By the way, those international accords are a farce. Those, Trump not signing those things, he's correct on that. It's caused all sorts of trouble, but those are critical storms. Those are a nightmare.
Yeah.
And if I could imagine them doing it well, but they have not, in my opinion. They're all just political grabs, power grabs, you know, freebies for underdeveloped country grabs. So Trump should just, we should get away from NATO. There's all sorts of things we should dump.
Yeah. What is the base art? One of the things I've never been able to get my hands around, and from the sounds of it, it's because there isn't an answer out there. But what is the evidence that points to, okay, more carbon emissions. I'm with you. I buy the fact that we're emitting more carbon than we've ever have. I'm with you. What is the hard evidence that they point to? One of the things, I've gotten in arguments with family and friends about this, where I just said, listen, I'm not saying it's not happening. What I'm saying is that this thing that we're widely accepting, that increased carbon creates global warming, where's the evidence of just that? What do they point to, Professor?
Well, you know, there is the greenhouse effect has strong, sound physical underpinnings, right?
Okay.
So the physicists figured out that, you know, you get various heat effects from having greenhouse gas. And they point out that, you know, they point out long ago that the reason the Earth is the temperature it is because we have this greenhouse effect. And so that's not insane. But what also turns out to be true is that the influence of CO2, it's a micro smidgen. So here's a stat for you. This was I don't know if this is true. But what I can tell you is a calculation done by a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. So if you want to say, yeah, but what does he know? That's fine. Trivial calculation, I presume. But he said if you calculate all the CO2 put out by the cars in the world in a year, and you imagine it going into the atmosphere and getting diluted, it is the equivalent of sitting in a 20 by 20 by 8-foot room and lighting a match and putting out CO2 once every 3 years.
That's how trivial we're talking.
That's how trivial the CO2 contribution is from the cars, supposedly. Meanwhile, there's feedback loops galore. So, for example, the more CO2, greenhouses pump up the CO2 from 400 ppm up to around 1500 to get better growth. So there's a natural feedback loop. The more CO2 the atmosphere has, the more greenery we're going to get. They say that, you know, CO2 correlates with temperature long term. There's these great plots showing the both going up and down over hundreds of thousands of years. The first thing I question is, how do you know? You know, I get the CO2 in ice cores. That looks pretty sound to me. But how do you measure temperature over those windows? And I just don't believe it. No one has ever presented a case where I say, oh, yeah, I can now picture that. No, I can't. These weird bristlecone pine dendrochronology. I wrote a paper on that once. I'm an expert now, apparently. and what they found was that, yes, CO2 correlates with temperature, but there's an 800-year lag. The temperature goes up first. The CO2 appears second with an 800-year lag. What that means is that CO2 isn't causing warming. Warming is causing CO2. And this is freshman chem. You warm the oceans, they degas.
Right.
You can watch this. It's called degassing, where if you heat us, if you boil us, here's how you can do the experiment. If you take water, instead of making ice cubes out of the water, you boil it on the stove and then you make ice cubes. You get clear ice cubes because you degassed it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you degas the oceans because they warmed, you'll boot out CO2. But that's not to say CO2 causes warming any more than saying if you warm that dead carcass to 98.7, it will be a live carcass. There's no correlation there. Now, here's the problem. I'm an amateur in this stuff. There could be climate scientists listening saying, no, you're wrong, you're wrong, you're wrong. Well, then speak up and speak coherently. And by the way, while you're speaking up, if you're a climate person, you're listening, make sure you shut the stupid people up along the way, because you can't just sit there silent and expect me to buy into your stupid model, because I have to wade through idiots pumping garbage into the system and somehow expect the scientists to say, oh, ignore all those people. We know what we're doing. Well, speak up. And clean up your own scientific community while you're at it, because if you don't clean up fraud, you are the problem.
Well, and Dave, here's one of my biggest issues is because the models have been blown to pieces. I mean, if these models, if we transferred this over to the investment community and models were this bad, these firms would be out of business, right? Making the correlation.
Actually,
between
they are that bad.
Well, okay.
Your model's just as bad, and they keep blowing up the world, too. Right?
Well, that, okay.
So there's a good analogy.
Well,
I'm going to throw this out for you macroeconomists. I am not convinced there's a shred of evidence that monetary policy influences the economy.
I agree.
The metaphor I use to explain this is my dog sits here and waits at the door. As soon as it gets kind of dark, sits and waits at the door for me to come home. And almost every single night I come home and the dog thinks it's causality.
Right.
And then once in a great while, I don't come home because I got to do something, right? And the dog doesn't know why that is. Well, then you get the economists and they start to see the economy turning down and they start pulling all the bells and whistles and switches. And amazing, some year or two later, the economy starts to recover. They think they did it.
Right.
What if their switches aren't even attached to the economy? What if they're totally – and then when they finally blew it badly in 08, 09, it just – that's when it showed up. They've been blowing it badly for decades. Greenspan says, oh, we had an error in our model. Well, my dog had an error in the model the night I came home at 11, not 6.
Right. Well, I – no, and I was pointing this out earlier. It's funny you bring this up. I am so tired of listening to the, well, hey, well, stock valuations are perfectly in line when you consider long-term interest rates. And one of the things I put
They're
out...
lying. That's such a lie. That's the biggest lie of them all.
It's an observation,
that's
right?
That's incorrect. There are so many big lies, that's not even close to the biggest lie of them all.
Right. No, but it's an observation. The point I was making was that this is an observation. This is looking at the current situation. This is the equivalent of your dog looking at the night coming and you coming home. Yet that's the way it is right now. Wait till it blows up, because it will. And they can drive interest rates. Look at Japan and Europe. And this is a point Jim Chanos pointed out on Twitter. So I'm stealing his thunder here a little bit, and I'm sure Mr. Chanos would mind. But it's point he if low interest rates equal high equity prices, explain Japan and Europe. And yet, and yet they keep recycling it over and over and over. Oh, well, it's totally justified. Well, go look at enterprise value versus sales. I mean, we're in the 99th percentile. GDP to market cap, we're approaching 160% if we haven't crossed it over. I mean,
you mean market cap to GDP?
Yeah, excuse me, market cap to GDP. Yeah, yeah. That ratio.
Last year, I assembled 20 metrics of valuation. A metric of valuation is always the market cap relative to something that the market cap ought to regress to and through the mean on regularly. So Buffett's favorite is market cap to GDP, which you just recited. Then there's market cap to sales, market cap to revenues. There's market cap to earnings. Be careful, they lie about earnings. There's market cap to average 10-year earnings. I cited 20 of them, and they all showed two things. And one is that we are approximately 2 times the historical norm. And maybe now the historical norms are relevant. Be careful with that assumption. And here's the second thing. In the depths of the 09 plunge, we really didn't get below the historical norm. So people go, oh, yeah, stocks were so cheap. No, they weren't.
Nope.
Not by historical metrics. Maybe they were. But in the last 10 years, while your equity market has gone up, you know, what is it, 270%? There's some big number.
It's like 340 on the S&P since the bottom.
The GDP grew 50%.
Right.
Max. Now, if GDP and market cap are supposed to track, you have a problem. Now, you say, oh, but that's because it was so bad in 09. And you go back and look at the plots. It wasn't that bad. We had regressed to the mean. And it felt painful because, by the way, regressing to the mean from 60,000 feet in the air is painful.
Yeah.
Right? And so it feels like you plumb some low. You didn't plumb a low. There is no evidence that those 09 lows were some – that was not like in 1981 when the P.E. of the whole market was 7.7, right? And I can tell you why that was true. There is an interest rate correlation. Let me put it this way. Here's where Chanos would agree, I think, and that is if the Fed jammed rates up to 6 or 7 or 8%, I can guarantee you P.E. ratios would correct.
Oh, right? Yeah. No, they're no without so, question.
Right. But the reason that they're jamming them down and the reason that, you know, I've only, by the way, run into one guy who actually thinks a 30-year bond returning 3% is actually a fair return when you think about where it'll be in 30 years. That's been a bug up my butt. And that is that if I said you buy a 30-year, here's an investment. You have to buy it. You have to hang on to it. You can't hedge it. It's just you're buying a revenue stream. It's 30 years. It's a U.S. Treasury. What, without knowing the future, without knowing inflation, without knowing anything, what would you demand as an interest rate on a 30-year bond? Give me your answer. Go ahead.
I'd probably be around 7.
Right. Put it this way. It wouldn't be 3.
No. Nowhere close.
And therefore, the bond market no longer reflects in any rational way the idea that people are purchasing revenue streams.
No, well, yeah.
So when did it become just a casino? When did the bond market become just a casino? I know the casino metaphor is old and trite, But when did it become the point? And everyone says, well, Dave, no one hangs on them for 30 years. I go, that's the stupidity of the bond market.
Yeah.
Because someone has to hang on to those for 30 years.
Someone's holding them.
There will be an owner. That's a Hussman model. Someone's going to own these overpriced assets until they become underpriced. And it may not be you. You might be a trader. You might be able to dodge out. Here's Joe Sixpack. Joe Sixpack can't buy a 30-year bond on the assumption that they will trade out of it. They're not good enough.
Well,
I couldn't do it. I'm pretty good at this stuff. I couldn't do it. You can't buy 10-year bonds to trade out of it. So whatever the return on that bond is, I buy, that's my return.
Right.
That will be it. And I'm not buying a bond that returns 3% over 30 years.
No. It just doesn't make any sense.
But if there was a market priced interest rate, if there was price discovery in the bond market,
okay,
that price would reflect that projection.
Well, and this is my point, and this is the thing that gets me so fired up about that argument. Is I look at those people and I go, well, first of all, you're assuming that you know what interest rates are. I don't know what the clearing cost of capital is right now. I don't know what interest rates are. They go, well, what are you talking about? You can look right here and go, guys, interest rates are what central banks want them to be. They're no more real than you know, Bigfoot.
Right.
Or what, I mean, what are interest rates, Dave? Do you know? I don't. I don't have a clue.
Well, I know what I can get.
Right.
But I don't know what they would be under unfettered conditions.
Well, the balance sheet, what I don't know is
here's what you're saying. I know what I can get in return for lending my capital. I don't know what my capital's actually worth.
Right. And
so what I know is that I would never lend to anyone for 30 years at 3%. No one.
Right. What rational minded investor would make that move? Nobody would, but we just blindly accept it.
Well, but there's a global bond market worth, what, $250 trillion or something that is priced this ridiculously.
Yeah.
So Japan has managed to completely and utterly destroy its bond market. There is no bond market left in Japan. There's nothing that approximates a bond market in Japan.
And yet it's still a safe haven. Yeah, it's still a safe haven.
Well, apparently. So what happens now, right? I don't know. It's a kind of a financial Alzheimer's disease or something. I don't know what happens from here.
Well, and this is where I was getting in. I don't mean to violently pivot again, but this is one of the things, and this is nothing new, and I don't mean to piggyback on this guy or beat him up, but just using it as an example, Jim Cramer came out today on CNBC, and he had an article where he was saying that he was wrong to be defending Boeing in the early days. Has it always been this bad? We did a show March 1st of last year, 2019, where we did a deep dive into Boeing over a 2.5 month period of time and interviewed about 7 different executives from all over the company. And we came back. This is the timing was, you know, we didn't know that another plane was going to crash 6 days later. So I'm not taking credit for that. And it's a horrible event. And nobody wants to celebrate this. But the thing that was the most frustrating to me, Dave, is no one. I mean, you know, guys like you and I, but we're the outliers. You know, we're kind of the fringe, you know, propeller heads, you know, wing nuts. Nobody seems to question this anymore. And you see it with global warming. You see it with anybody that took the time to talk to anybody at Boeing other than the CEO and dug into the financials, dug into the assumptions they were making about the backlog. Dave, I'm not Jim Chanos. I'm not one of these guys. I'm not a forensic accounting. The information was there if you cared to take a look, and nobody did. And everybody rushed.
Well, so I wrote about Boeing last year, not at the end of 19, end of 18. But I didn't pick on how bad things were in Boeing. What I picked up on is how Boeing had become a sort of a bubble stock.
Yeah.
But my thought was, I think my angle was, I have to go back and read this now, was that the defense industry is now kind of a bubble industry. Or so here's the problem. So the defense industry, everything had done remarkably well, and we weren't at war. And I'm thinking either people have bid these things up to the stratosphere in the usual ridiculous, that's where the money's going, so that's where I'm going, and therefore when the music stops, I'm getting out fast, right? The whole stupid logic. Or the dexterous people make a fortune.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, we ran over, but if you want to hear the remainder of this interview, which I strongly suggest, You can go to the podcast at mynorthwest.com, or you can just Google Know Your Risk Radio Stitcher. We're on Stitcher. We're on a bunch of different podcast websites. Just Google Know Your Risk Radio podcast. It'll come up. You can get the interview with Professor Colum on there. Anyway, we got to run. Thank you so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be back next week. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.
Thanks for listening to Know Your Risk Radio. Whether it's preservation of capital or an aggressive growth strategy, every investor needs a clearly defined risk profile. Schedule your free risk review at knowyourriskradio.com. Tune in next week to Know Your Risk Radio with your host, Zach Abraham, Chief Investment Officer at Bulwark Capital Management.
Opinions expressed in this program are for general information purposes only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual or any specific security. It is only intended to provide education about the financial industry. To determine which investments may be appropriate for you, consult your financial advisor prior to investing. Any past performance discussed during this program is no guarantee of future results. Any indices referenced for comparison are unmanaged and cannot be invested into directly. As always, please remember investing involves risk and possible loss of principal capital. Please seek advice from a licensed professional. Bulwark Capital Management is an investment advisor representative of Clear Creek Financial Management, a registered investment advisor.